I'm Steve Kraske, and this is KCUR's Up to Date. Poison gas has killed millions of civilians, but the use of chemicals as weapons came to the fore in 1915 when German forces released chlorine into the air and waited for the wind to carry it into Allied trenches. Now, Kansas City is hosting a vivid reminder of the horrors of chemical warfare. Today we learn about a massive painting commemorating the estimated 90,000 killed by gas in the Great War. Then, one journalist wasn't satisfied with just reading about Russia from afar. He moved there and spent years getting an insider's view of life in Moscow. He'll tell us about it. Stay tuned later for the weekend to-do list. We'll get you up to date after this hour's news. World War I was not even a year old when in April of 1915, the Germans launched the first major gas attack against French soldiers. For the remainder of the Great War, both sides would develop and use chemical weapons, resulting in 500,000 injured and almost 30,000 dead. From that horror came one of the greatest war paintings, Gassed by John Singer Sargent. Normally at home in England's Imperial War Museums, the large-scale work, which is 9 by 21 feet in its frame, is currently on tour in the U.S. for only the second time. For the first time, it is in the Midwest, in an exhibition at the new Wiley Gallery at the National World War I Museum. Joining me now to tell the story of this extraordinary painting are Doran Cart. He's senior curator for the National World War I Museum and Memorial. Doran, nice to have you. Good morning.
Morning, Steve.
Robert Cozzolino is Patrick and Amy Butler Curator of Paintings at the Minneapolis Institute of Art. Robert, nice to have you.
Yeah, it's been nice to be here, Steve. Nice to hear your voice, Doran.
Nice to hear yours, Bob.
Bob, start us off here with a description of the painting's subject matter. What is it?
So when you see the painting, all the figures are almost life-size. And you encounter it as though you yourself are coming across a scene that Sargent witnessed himself. It's a dressing station near the Western Front, and what you see is a pile of bodies sort of writhing in agony at the foot of the painting. And then in the middle frame, or middle sort of ground, you see a row of soldiers who are lined up with their left arms and right arms in front of them, holding on to the shoulders of the men in front of them. So they're lined up and keeping in contact with one another because, as you gradually realize, they are the victims of a gas attack. Their bandaged eyes are there, and they're all sort of looking in different directions. Clearly, they don't really have their bearings. One guy is breaking line to vomit. And so Sargent really was very attentive to all the details, and I think the humanity of the scene. And so then you see another row of guys in the distance on the far right who are also lined up, and they're about to mobilize and start walking towards what is probably a tent that sort of, if you're thinking about this as a film, off camera, where they will be then taken to a proper military hospital. So it's this harrowing scene that Sargent, after being very frustrated with not finding anything to him worthy of depicting, came across himself.
But he was best known as a portrait artist, Bob. I mean, why was he picked for this painting?
I know. That's one of the great sort of dramatic differences between what people know of Sargent, what his popular image is, and then what he produced in 1918 and 1919. He really had to be kind of goaded into it, in part by his friend William James, the writer, and also Henry Tonks, who was another artist, a British artist, who was depicting the war wounded a lot during the war. He was commissioned by the British government to depict images of Anglo-American cooperation for what was going to be a planned Hall of Remembrance. And so, you know, Sargent was game for this sort of begrudgingly, but he went around the Western Front. He first produced a whole bunch of watercolors that really seemed to show the irony and the the absurdities of war, a lot of weird juxtapositions, like a farmer in a field with a downed plane and things like that. But it was really this that moved him and provided this boost for
right.
to really show what the war, what the war's cost really was.
Doran, you oversaw the arrival and the installation of this very large painting. Again, I mentioned it's 9 by 21 feet in its frame. I understand that a major change to the painting helped to make it lighter. Explain what that was.
Well, a few years ago, at the Imperial War Museums in England, they actually put an aluminum stretcher on the back of it instead of the wood, and so that lightened it up as far and gave more of a handhold to move the painting, because it travels in a traveling frame and not in its display frame, which comes separately in a crate and has to be put together. So the painting has to be handled and placed into the frame itself before it's placed on the wall.
So how do you wind up protecting a painting of that size from any surface damage, you know, while it's being transported?
Very carefully.
Yeah, I bet.
I saw it installed at the Frist Center in Nashville, and then brought their preparator here with the painting to make sure that we had expertise in that. And it's actually in the traveling frame, which extends over the top of the painting a few inches. And then there are straps, linen straps, that go over the top of it, which keeps anything from getting actually on the surface of the painting. And then it's in plastic. So it's very well protected in the traveling frame. Then it's when it's installed, it's placed on the ground, or in the gallery, not on the ground, but on the floor of the gallery, and that's removed, and then it's placed in the frame itself.
Well, what did you have to do to the gallery itself and the Wiley Museum to get it set to go and get it into the room?
Well, the Wiley Gallery is brand new at the National World War I Museum and Memorial, and so we actually built a wall in the new gallery specifically for the painting.
Really?
To be on, and then when the exhibition is open, is done on June 3rd, the wall will disappear, because we'll have another exhibition to go in that space, which takes a different type of use of the gallery itself.
Bob, how do you think Kansas Cityans are going to react the first time they see this thing?
Everybody that I've ever witnessed seeing this painting is just in awe. I mean, it's a marvel. The technical tour de force, but really, I'm sure your viewers could Google an image of it, or your listeners can do that, but the quality of paint, I think artists will be fascinated by it. There's so much in it, in the background, that Sargent put in there. Like, there's these guys playing sort of able soldiers who sort of out of uniform playing soccer in the background, as a kind of dramatic contrast to these wounded guys. There's so much to see in it. It first, just the impact of it grips you, because it is almost life size, as I said. And Sargent really did, think of every one of those guys as an individual. You know, they're not just sort of symbolic stand-ins. They're people he saw. We know he sketched them in pencil first. And so the scale has this huge effect. And then you start to really look around to see all these little vignettes that Sargent is putting in there. So I think it's just a marvel, and it is a kind of picture that can stand alone and have a whole show around it.
You know, did he have free rein to paint what he wanted to paint here, Bob, or was he commissioned to do something more specific?
So it was pretty vague. And so I think Sargent, partly because of his stature and because, they figured they would get something strong. I don't think they realized just what kind of a picture Sargent would come up with, nor did he, because he didn't really know what he was going to paint. They didn't dictate any of the terms of this picture as it was in progress. It was really up to Sargent to do it. I think because it was going to be in this planned Hall of a Remembrance, its scale is probably one of those things that there may have been some specifications about, but not the subject matter.
This is Up to Date. We're talking about the war painting Gas at the National World War I Museum. It's a 9 by 21 foot artwork that will be on display in the Wiley Gallery from February 23rd through June 3rd. Singer Sargent was at the front in 1918, Dorn, and he presented the work a year later. Was the paint even dry?
Yes, I'm pretty sure it was. He was really inspired, I think, by what he saw. And
even though he had a hard time finding it, it sounds like.
Yes. Yeah. And he and Henry Tonks, who traveled together south of Arras, France, where the British front line was, and he made incredible sketches, which we will have in the exhibition as well for people to see. So he took that back, and he was really, to me, was very inspired not only by the scene, but also by the unpreparedness that he saw of these men that were unprepared for the gas attacks that they had been forced into. They didn't have proper uniforms for it. They had gas masks, but it really depended on what kind of gas it was, how effective they were. Hmm. And so he made a statement there as well. But he really, and Bob knows, he was really needed to get this painting done. And yeah. And there are quite incredible details. Like the first time that I saw it, I thought there was something wrong at the top of it because there were these little bumps. But actually, they're airplanes that he put on there in
the
a very heavy paint. They're the biplanes. And so then there's also the burst of the anti-aircraft fire that are around these airplanes. So I think the people that I've shown it to as we've gotten it put together at the museum have been just astounded by it. I've seen the painting 8 times over the course of years, and I'm still amazed by the detail that's there, the light, and how he painted the light on their faces.
Well, Bob, speaking of the light, you know, the painting is almost monochromatic, you know, with all the uniforms the same color and the sky overcast but filtering the sunlight, so it's almost a light version of that uniform color. You wouldn't think that that would make the painting all that interesting, but that's not the case. Why is that?
I'm glad you brought that up. It's another little spark of Sargent's genius that the whole painting has these tones of yellow, which seem to be Sargent permeating the entire scene with this kind of reflection of yellow or mustard, and painting them all like that. And it really does feel like there's this sort of bitterness seeping into the picture. In fact, Virginia Woolf, when she first saw it, said that she felt like the painting, and particular one step in there, one sort of detail of this soldier almost in the center who's making this exaggerated step up because he can't see a plank of wood that he's probably been told to step up, and so he's doing this exaggerated step. And she said it was like that was, quote, the final scratch of the surgeon's knife, which is said to hurt more than the whole operation. So a lot of people, when they saw this first, really did see it as a moral kind of allegory of blindness, moral blindness, but also physical blindness. And Sargent did base that lineup probably on something he witnessed, because it's a practical way of getting these guys to walk safely to where they're going to be evacuated from. But he also was looking at a Peter Bruegel painting from the 1500s called A Parable of the Blind Leading the Blind. And so Sargent's, you know, working that stuff in there, even though it's really an eyewitness scene. He's putting those other kinds of symbolic layers in there.
Dorn, is this piece of art regarded as a great work?
Well, I think it is because of its importance to the story of World War One. I'm not a.
How about in terms of its painting, in terms of the art there?
Well, I will defer to Bob on that one because he's more of the art curator. I'm the material culture guy.
Bob, what do you say to that?
Oh, it absolutely is. I think in part because here's an artist who's near the end of his career. The man's already done, you know, amazing things and had accolades and success in every possible way, and yet still has the capacity to surprise probably himself as well as his audience. And I think, you know, the messages in it are still relatable. And even though it was painted over 100 years ago or finished over 100 years ago, I think that, you know, it has this freshness and has I think it's to Sargent's credit that he didn't try to adopt an all-current style. Like, he didn't make it ultra-modern. So it really seems to speak across generations.
You know, Doran, along with the painting, the museum is also going to display gas masks. Why?
Well, we wanted to go beyond the painting itself, although it is the main part of the exhibition, to show how poison gas, chemical warfare, affected not only the world in 1915 to 1918, but also all the way to current times.
Mm-hmm.
And we decided to show protection and detection, because this is what really people had to adapt to almost immediately from when the first successful poison gas attacks occurred in 1915. And so we do that because that's part of our mission as well, to show that World War I is still an incredible influence on the world today and events that are occurring.
Do you show contemporary gas masks along with the old ones?
Yes, we actually show from the first ones in 1916 all the way up to the current masks that are worn by the United States forces.
So how did soldiers back in World War I times detect mustard oil or the chlorine gas that they had to face?
Well, there were several ways they could see it, primarily first, if it was a clear day. We have one thing in our exhibition that will, I think visitors will be interested in. It's a little box that has holes in it, and they would put a mouse in it. And if it was out in front there, and if the gas would hit it, the mouse first, and if it died, then you better get your gas mask on.
That's how they measured those things.
Yes, and then they had different warnings. They had bells and whistles. They would clang on empty artillery shells. They had ratchets that they would twist. And so the warning part of it, they had to know that it was coming, but sometimes they didn't, and sometimes it surprised them.
Do we know what it was like to survive one of those gas attacks? What kind of pain those guys had to go through?
Well, of course, the different types of gas affected them differently. Some were respiratory. The mustard gas or mustard oil was a burner that would burn like their eyes and the mucus around their eyes. And so they affected them differently. And it was the gas was applied in different manners depending on the weather.
After the exhibition, go ahead, Bob.
I just add one thing: George O'Keefe's brother, Alexis, served, and he was involved in a gas attack, a battle that involved that, and he suffered respiratory effects the rest of his life and died early because of it. She, in fact, made a memorial painting to him, in part based on that. So, there's lots of instances where we know of how it affected, anecdotally because of letters, the soldiers who did return home, and a lot of times it cut their lives short.
Okay, we'll have to leave our conversation there. This artwork, Gassed, will be on display from tomorrow through June 3rd. You ready to go?
Yes,
Okay, that's Doran Kark. You better be ready, Doran, senior curator for the National World War I Museum and Memorial. He was joined by Bob Cozzolino, Patrick and Amy Butler, curator of paintings at the Minneapolis Institute of Art. Thanks, you both. Sure appreciate it.
Thanks, Steve.
Thank you.
Nice to hear from you, Bob.
Time for a break. When we come back, we'll visit modern-day Russia and get a sense of what it's like to live there under Putin. I'm Steve Kraske, and you're listening to Up to Date on 89.3 KCUR. And we're back. I'm Steve Kraske. Tomorrow, film critics give us the lowdown on the short films getting big attention from the Academy, and we'll let you know what to expect at the critically acclaimed Film Fest that happens in the middle of Missouri. That's tomorrow on KCUR's Up to Date. Well, Michael Idov tells a story about getting caught in a Moscow traffic jam just ahead of an emergency medical van with its lights whirling and its siren wailing. But no one would move. Why? People in Russia knew that ambulance drivers make money on the side selling trips to the airport. Maybe someone in need was in that van, or maybe not. That cynicism permeates Russian society these days, with a resulting breakdown in trust between individual and institution, which may be exactly what's happening in the U.S. these days. Michael Idoff is the author of a book that looks at modern-day Russia, Dressed Up for a Riot, Misadventures in Putin's Moscow. He's a three-time winner of the National Magazine Award for his writing, and he's a former editor of GQ Russia. And Michael, so nice to have you. Good morning.
Hi, Steve. Thank you for having me.
You know, I'm fascinated by this idea that the U.S. may be on the verge of the same deep cynicism that you find in Russia these days. If that comes to pass, what are we in for?
Well, not just cynicism, but, you know, also maybe some of the hope as well, because it's interesting just the last few days, you know, how much the sort of the opposition to Trump kind of mirrors some of the sort of moods that the Russian opposition to Putin has gone through over the last few years. For example, for a few years from 2014 or so, it was in this kind of a circular firing squad mode. And then, you know, just the last couple of days, I keep seeing in the aftermath of this terrible massacre in Florida, I keep seeing this sort of the kids will save us, you know, the teens will save us sentiment that was actually really familiar to me from sort of spring, summer of 2017 when Alexei Navalny, the main, sort of the chief opposition to Putin, has started attracting, you know, 15, 16-year-olds to his cause. So, yeah, there's a lot of the same cynicism, but also kind of the same sort of these sparks of hope. And it's fascinating to see the U.S. kind of follow in Russia's footsteps there.
So why are Russians so cynical, Michael?
I think this is what naturally comes as a consequence of being governed for a period of time by demonstrably corrupt people. I mean, that's basically it, right? And the U.S. is very early into this experience, but Russia has pretty much always been like this, and it's just at some point you throw up these defensive shields. You say, you know what, I'm opting out of all of this. All politics is dirty. All institutions are fake and just facades for, you know, concealing the avarice of the people in charge of these institutions. It's all, you know, a simulacrum of a simulacrum. And all I have is my family, my life, and I'm just going to take care of that.
So ultimately, all this cynicism then breeds defeatism, is what you write.
I think so. Because
that's discouraging.
Well, in a way.
And understandable,
I mean,
yeah.
It's, you know, it's a conspiratorial mindset, first of all, like, because it's easier to think that the world is run by a shadowy conspiracy than it is to take your own responsibility for changing it or for, you know, not having done enough to change it. For example, you know, on the American side, if I may say so, this sort of this constant blaming of, you know, of the Russian, you know, the Russian interference in the 2016 election, yeah, the Russians did do it just like they did in the previous election cycle and every election cycle before that, predating the internet. It's just that now, you know, their guy won, so they got very, very lucky. And so basically when we, you know, when we say, okay, the Russians did it, it's also therapeutic. You just, you know, we try to think of the, you know, think of this interference as if it actually swung the election. So it wasn't us, it wasn't the American people who elected Trump. It was a hostile actor from the outside. That's also a kind of defensive therapy, you know.
Michael Idoff is my guest. We're talking about modern-day Russia, his new book, Dressed Up for a Riot, Misadventures in Putin's Moscow. You know, your parents left Russia in the early 90s in a move that you describe as the bravest, most radical act of their lives. Why did they leave?
Well, it's interesting because they didn't actually leave the Soviet Union. They have lived through the end of the Soviet Union. And my family comes from Latvia, which was occupied by the Soviet Union twice, in fact, and was a part of the Soviet Union until the early 1990s. And it was after the breakup of the Soviet Union that my family realized that they couldn't keep living in Latvia, which was just turning on them as so-called occupants, you know, and saw representatives of the Soviet regime in them, just as the Soviets, the Russians, would only see Jews in them and would never, basically neither side would recognize them as fellow citizens, and was just, it got too much. They weren't all that happy about leaving, but they did. So that happened in 1992. I think if they could have left in the 70s, and then, you know, I would have been born in the United States. But, you know, this way, it worked out. It worked out for them. It worked out for me.
And yet, in 2011, things flipped, and you found yourself moving back to Russia. Why?
Well, part of it was just fortuitous timing, because I was in Russia doing a magazine story when I got offered to run the Russian edition of the GQ magazine. But the reason I said yes was sort of more complicated than that, because just then, at that moment, there was something really exciting happening in Russia. And you have to think all the way back to 2011 to remember, you know, the Tahrir Square and the Arab Spring and Occupy Wall Street to an extent. And just what was happening in Russia was part and parcel of that, a kind of horizontal resistance movement that felt really new and exciting after almost 15 years of just complete apathy from the Russians, the apathy that Russia has now returned to largely, unfortunately. And yeah, I mean, you have to remember that 4,000 people came out to protest Putin on December 4th, 2011. And then on December 10th, 60,000 people came out. Hmm. And on December 24th, 100,000 people. So it felt like it was snowballing and no one knew where it would lead. So just at that moment, I got this job offer and I was basically thinking, I need to be there. This is the place to be. I need to witness this.
So what did your parents say about your decision to go back? Because, and I, it was fun to read, you were fretting over what the heck you were going to say to them to explain yourself.
They were not super happy, and I completely understand them. I mean, yeah. They have sacrificed a lot to get me out of, you know, out of the sort of the remnants of the Soviet Union, if not Russia proper. And they sacrificed a lot to get me an American education and all that. And, of course, watching me just kind of like back up and take my one-year-old, you know, infant daughter and actually go to Moscow, of course, gave them pause. But, you know, to their endless credit, they kind of let it ride out. And, you know, yeah, they didn't say no.
You describe the Russia of today as this hybrid regime. How so?
Well, a hybrid regime, by definition, is an autocratic regime that retains the facade of a democracy, that goes through the motions of a democracy, that backs up every autocratic move with, you know, legalese. And that's basically what it is. There is, you know, there's a so-called managed opposition, you know, the pseudo-opposition parties and politicians like the communists and Yabloko that are allowed to exist, basically, as long as they don't get too popular. And then there, of course, is the sort of the unmanageable opposition, the true opposition represented at this point almost entirely by Alexei Navalny's movement. And they, of course, are not allowed on the air or allowed to build an actual organization in the run-up to the current elections. And in fact, Navalny had several trumped up court cases against him just so that he could always be dragged off to jail if need be, et cetera, et cetera. And at the same time, all of this is done, you know, through the courts. It's all done. Like, it's not, you know, thugs grabbing you in the middle of the night. It's all done in a very sort of legal seeming manner.
Let's turn to Putin himself. Throw some words at me that describe him.
Well, faceless is the first word that comes to mind. Honestly, it's just I had a conversation, a really interesting conversation last night with somebody who wants to make a movie about Putin, and I was just trying to kind of formulate why I can't imagine a movie like this, because he's sort of a hero with no qualities, or a villain with no motivation. You know, it's he's a cog in the machine that somehow has outgrown the entire machine and kind of became the machine. But none of this makes him interesting as a human being in any way. He seems to be a man with very pedestrian ambitions, appetites, and kind of reactions to the world events. I have to hand him one thing. You know, he's not a brilliant strategist at all, because there is no strategy to the current Russia. He's a brilliant tactician. He reacts brilliantly to the issues of the day in order to survive the day and to, you know, go on. That is basically the beginning and the end of the entire raison d'etre of today's Russia, is just to keep this regime perpetuating itself. And he's been brilliant at it. Obviously, he's outplayed a lot of his detractors.
I was going to say, you know, opposition candidates obviously can't beat him. And the Russian protest movement, as you write early in the book, loses steam over a lack of unity. Why was it so hard for the opposition to unify to begin with?
Well, I think we know the answer. You know, for some reason, you know, the liberal movements are always a little too concerned with the purity of their own ranks in order to move forward decisively. You know, the whole Democrats fall in love, Republicans fall in line, thing. It's true. It's true. And there's that very self-defeating idea that whoever the Democrats, or in this case, you know, the anti-Putin liberal movement, puts forward has to be an absolutely flawless human being. And of course, since no flawless human beings exist, the opposition spent crucial days and weeks when it was sort of, you know, when it was actually had some momentum behind it, just squabbling, you know, these kind of intramural squabblings just doomed it. And I hope therein lies a good lesson for, you know, for the homegrown resistance movement, of course.
You write about how the Kremlin often inaccurately attributes protests to American funding rather than to authentic civil unrest. Why? And how long has this been going on?
Well, that's a tricky one, isn't it?
Yes,
it is. Because, as we all know, the U.S. did have a hand in, you know, fomenting a few regime changes around the world. And even if it didn't actually, you know, do that in Ukraine, for example, in 2004 and 2013, you know, it's not a very strong position to present when all the U.S. can say is like, yeah, we used to do it, we don't do it anymore. So it's quite, you know, so it's quite understandable, sort of this, the KGB mindset, that, you know, the Putin mindset is basically that there are two world actors jostling for influence all over the world. That's the U.S. and Russia. And everything else that happens in the world can be attributed either to U.S. meddling or the Russian meddling. And so in Putin's mind, I think Russia is doing only what the U.S. has been doing. You know? So it's difficult. It also doesn't help that when the Ukrainians revolted in 2013, people like Victoria Nuland and John McCain would just go to Kyiv and kind of showboat and do, and have photo ops on the Kyiv's Independence Square, kind of egging on the protesters. But that's what America does, right? It's in our sort of DNA to cheer on the freedom movements all over the world. The problem is that this kind of enthusiasm for, you know, freedom in the Russian eyes is malicious meddling. And then they just do the same because they presume that that is what the Americans have done in Ukraine to take it out of the Russian sphere of influence. So I would say that the entirety of Russia's current foreign policy is based on Putin's response to his idea that the Americans fomented civil unrest in 2011 on the streets of Moscow.
Michael Idov's new book, Dressed Up for a Riot, Misadventures in Putin's Moscow. You know, you've worked in the media and you've been in Russia. How do you, what's your sense about to what extent Russians trust their news sources over there?
Well, it's not even that the Russians do it. It's just that the way we all, you know, we all deal with the surfeit of information and unverifiable information and viral information is we are both extremely cynical and extremely gullible at once. It's a very strange mix. And I think that's what the Russians are also, they are, everyone is looking, you know, it's just confirmation bias. Everyone is looking for stories that confirm their gut feeling suspicions about the state of things in the world. So what happens is that you believe all stories, no matter how flimsy, that support your point of view, and you reject all stories, no matter how well-founded or well-researched or reported, that don't. And honestly, that's one of the most puzzling things for me, because I don't know how to fight that. I honestly don't. I think that's the question all of us in the media are asking ourselves now.
How much attention is this investigation, this ongoing investigation in this country over collusion between the Trump campaign and the Russian government? How much attention is that getting, and what do people make of it?
Well, at the top, you know, I'm sure they love it, you know. Finally, America is as obsessed with Russia as Russia always thought it was, and as Russia always hoped it would be. Because after years, decades of spending millions and tens of millions, actually hundreds of millions of dollars on, you know, just harebrained schemes like Russia Today, you know, and using Western PR agencies like Ketchum in order to shore up Russia's image abroad and just kind of make the West talk about Russia. And all of this money was, you know, what wasn't embezzled was just wasted. Suddenly, after all that, Putin doesn't even have to do anything. He can just kick back, relax, and watch the Americans ascribe everything happening in the world to his, you know, tactical and strategic brilliance. This is an amazing, like, can't lose type of situation to find yourself in.
How do they view President Trump, Michael?
Well, I think that a lot of the initial response was kind of, you know, there's a Russian saying or kind of an idiom, "больше ада," which means like more hell, like, you know, more hell meaning like bring on the, you know, kind of bring on the destruction of everything. It's like, let's, you know, just kind of like, it's because it's more fun this way. So I think that originally they saw Trump as this kind of like a Bolshe Ada type trickster figure, and was a lot of fun for them to watch. But I think at this point, it's like the as a joke, it's gotten a little old. So I think they're just waiting to see what, like, how the hell do you formulate, you know, an actual foreign policy here? Because, you know, he's signing sanctions, he doesn't sign sanctions. Like, it's even in matters that directly pertain to Russia, it's actually really hard to ascertain what the position is.
Do you have any gut sense of where the investigation into Trump might wind up?
Well, I wish I had, obviously, but to be honest, I think that the important thing is not in the investigation, at least the way I see it. It's not the collusion in the sense of, you know, political or like just kind of like a spy world sort of, you know, criminal collusion. It's money, and it's corruption. And I think that to be compromised by Russia doesn't mean to be a sleeper agent or a Manchurian candidate. To be compromised by Russia is basically just be compromised by greed, and be compromised by this sort of short-sighted tackiness. And, you know, and we know that that is actually the case, because the evidence is right there.
Michael Idov's new book, Dressed Up for a Riot, Misadventures in Putin's Moscow. Michael, thanks for taking us on a journey here to Russia. I sure appreciate it.
Thank you, Steve.
You can follow us on Twitter. We're at KCUR. Up to date, follow me at Steve Kraske. And tomorrow, our film fanatics join us. Once again, we'll talk about the Oscar-nominated shorts and where you can see them ahead of the big day. Our show is produced by Danny Alexander, Luke Martin, Kathleen Pointer, and Claire Verbeck. I'm Steve Kraske, and you are up to date.